Hello, and you're very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast, coming to you from Sydney, a couple of days out from the third British and Irish Lions test against the Wallabies. And we've waited until today to bring you your podcast because we were waiting for the team news, and that is in the Lions and the Wallabies both confirming their sides in the last few hours. To run through it, two changes for the Lions this week. James Ryan starts in the second row. Ollie Chessam drops back to the bench. Blair Kinghorn is onto the left wing. James Lowe drops out of the match day 23 after last week, but not an injury, according to Andy Farrell. There's no Joe McCarthy or Mac Hansen again this week. Farrell said they were close. Joe McCarthy could be needed if there's a late injury, but he said they were only around 80-85%. And just haven't had the time out on the training pitch over the last couple of weeks. Also, interestingly, a 6-2 split on the bench. No place for Josh van der Fleer, though. Ben Earl gets that spot. And Tadhg Furlong, his 9th Lions start out of a possible 9. Only 4 players have started more consecutive tests in British and Irish Lions history. That's Willie John McBride, Graham Price, Reese Williams and Tony O'Reilly. We will talk about that feat for Tadhg Furlong. For Australia, they've made 4 changes from the team that were beaten last week. Dylan Peach comes onto the left wing in place of the injured Harry Potter. Nick White starts at scrum half. This is going to be the 35-year-old's final appearance for the Wallabies before his retirement later on this year. Taniela Tupou is in a tight head prop. He comes straight into the starting team after Alan Alalatoa was ruled out with a shoulder injury. And the last change, Tom Hooper also goes from outside the match day 23 straight into the starting team. He starts at blindside flanker, replacing the injured Rob Valentini, who did come back from injury last week and played the first 40 minutes, but obviously wasn't fully there, despite playing a brilliant first half last week. So Tom Hooper starts in his place. Guys, before we get into the big incidents from last week, I might just touch on this team news. As I said, Johnny Holland and Johnny Murphy with me again this week. I should have said earlier, 2 changes for the Lions. I'm going to start with James Ryan. Johnny Holland, I'll come to you first. James Ryan, because he's someone we spoke about on this podcast last week as someone who was probably included in the match day 23 for the second test, despite not really playing his best stuff. Some people would have said Scott Cummings might have been outplaying him form-wise. We also would have talked about that with Tadhg Byrne and Tom Curry the week before. James Ryan came on in the second half last week and absolutely hit everything that moved. And to his credit, this is the second game in a row now where Andy Farrell has made a big call in backing Irish players as well. And for the second week in a row, it's worked out. And James Ryan's full value for his place in the starting team.
I'm feeling fairly smug with this one. No, I'm not. I just what we would have said last week is he has the ability to whack people. And I thought that's why he got onto the bench. And I actually think that's why he's starting now as well, because there was a moment where he was a Wilson that he whacked twice on the shot right on in the open. Yeah. I think he caused a knock on. And there are some of the things, like I said last week, you just don't feel like, you know, for coaches, it's a good turnover. And even if it's not a turnover, you know that you're imposing yourself on the opposition, much like Skelton and Valentini did on the other side of the ball, you know. So I just think there's some things, I wouldn't call them intangible, because if you look at the game over and over, you'll see them. And we don't do that because, you know, it's not our job to look at it 3 times from every different angle. But I think if you do go through moments like that, you know, that's probably where, you know, the casual supporter, even people who are looking at it more, you still don't see as much as what the coaches see, and then never mind the training pitch. So I think there's some of the reasons why. And then he had a really good carry tidying up from Finn Russell, didn't he, for the just before Hugo Keenan.
Right.
Not that the other back fives might not have done it, but he still had a moment, and they stand out in your head, and sometimes they're the things that dictate your thought process as a coach. I actually think it's easy for me to say, again, not coaching them, but I think the selection is underwhelming. You know, I thought there might have been 1 or 2 more changes, but again, there's a lot of calls for consistency, ruthlessness, beat them 3-0 and everything else. But the other side of me was thinking, was there an Irish aspect of, like, you know, not overplaying some guys? You know, they do have to come back into another season, and the longer they're playing, the more they have to rest. So I did wonder, was there, like, James Lowe, you know, it is a selection thing, I would say. Johnny, you might touch on next, you were talking about there, but I think James Lowe is one of those people that he either starts, he's not involved. We've spoken with other guys like that. He's not going to sneak onto a bench, and when it's a 6-2, he certainly won't. But James Ryan, I think, is full value for a test cap.
I'll get on to James Lowe in just a moment, but Johnny Murphy, I might just carry on the James Ryan thread with you here, because it is a really it's a really interesting arc that Ryan has had now this summer, where he came into the tour, was carrying that injury that after the URC final, and was slow to get his debut on tour. And even I remember earlier on this summer, we had someone, we didn't discuss it on the podcast, but I had a listener getting in touch to ask about, we should be talking about how James Ryan's career was fading away, that he wasn't going to be making a Lions test team. And it looked like he was kind of going through the motions for the first couple of games out there. Then he gets his chance on the bench last week, and now he takes his starting spot. It's been a really fascinating arc from his point of view over this summer.
Yeah, and I think we touched on it last week, and people would have talked about it around the selection of the overall test team, that he probably was lucky, and he was one of those players that was picked out of, you know, we've used the phrase credit, a bit of credit in the bank with Andy Farrell. And I suppose his underwhelming performances again led to last week, kind of a questionable kind of selection over Cummins, who had been good, but the writing was on the wall, given he came off early in the midweek game. And at the same time, he really delivered. Like, you look at how violent he was around the rooks. He just came on and absolutely melted people. And when they went, they probably lacked that in the 10-minute period where Australia had their real ascendancy in the game and they were down to 14 men. Skelton and Valentini coming around the corner. They played quite close, as we thought. Again, we spoke about that last week, just getting close around the corner, 9, multiple runners, getting Skelton and Valentini on the ball, and then trying to kick and win the kick-kick battle. And for the first 25 minutes, Australia did that. So I suppose from a selection point of view, what he did in the last 20-25 minutes, it's probably, you know, a bit more kind of like, a bit like Sunday was from a man marking perspective. Every time Skelton comes around the corner, you'll probably see, you know, James Ryan trying to line him up and add that physicality. And he give, with Joe McCarthy out, you can see it as a bit more of a like for like change, given Chesham's athleticism, and not that he's not powerful and he can't whack people, but he's just a different type of second row to what to what James Ryan and Joe McCarthy are. So fair play to him grabbing that. You know, he really, really did stand up and took that 20 minutes. And you know, a lot of people were talking about how lucky he was, but you know, he delivered, and he delivered for Andy Farrell, like so many guys have that he has backed in those situations.
Johnny Holland mentioned James Lowe. Johnny Murphy, do you want to just kind of elaborate on that? And his performance at the weekend, and second of all, with him not in the team, what are the challenges that presents now in terms of a kicking option?
I thought James Lowe didn't have his best game last week. You know, even for he pops out of the line, even defensively, one of his kind of bad habits originally when he first came to Ireland was kind of, you know, his reads on the edge, goes from intercepts, gets completely isolated, and they take his back. And you know, he had that incredible moment for the try where he gets, you know, inside, then gets that offload. But outside of that, I felt he probably lacked a bit. He wasn't great in the air. King Horton did make a big difference when he came on, particularly when he was swinging off his left wing into those into those positions out the back with short runners, and he got a lot of traction there on outside shoulders. So for me, very much a form selection. And Blair Kinghorn has done incredibly well, and he's a worldly of a player, but James Lowe, he had a bit of an underwhelming performance last week. For me, in terms of the balance and the kicking game, and I suppose with James Lowe a bit off kilter last week, they didn't, as Johnny said before we came on, he didn't really have that left foot option either, but it does cut your with a 6-2 split, it does potentially cut your kicking options then, and makes it a bit harder for your decision makers 9 and 10. With no massive other kind of big boots in the back three from a left foot perspective, it cuts down your options a small bit. So you're not opening up the field. And just with the 6-2 split, it can hinder you a bit, but look, it didn't hinder them in the last 25 minutes when they were pushing for the win last week. So Yeah, but definitely a form selection for me. I just felt James Lowe was just a bit off pace last week.
Johnny Holland, then, if we're talking about the 6-2 split and the impact that has then as well. So Owen Farrell and Alex Mitchell are the two backline replacements out there. If, for example, either Tommy Freeman or Blair Kinghorn pick up an injury inside those first few minutes, are you pretty much looking at either Jameson Gibson-Park or Alex Mitchell playing out on one of those wings?
I was thinking about this. I just don't know where Hugh Jones, like, will he
shift out?
Yeah, will he flick out there and then put Farrell into the centre? That I was thinking Jameson Gibson-Park, but then I was wondering, like, you know, I questioned why Tate McDermott went down. I know I text you about it. Like, why did he go on ahead of Donaldson when Donaldson is an actual full back and you could put Tom Wright onto the wing? So I don't think he'll set himself up for Gibson Park to be the first winger, like, you know. So it has to be Hugh Jones, and then push him out Farrell into centres, into first centre, and push them all out. So that's the way I think it's going to go. I do wonder, even, you know, they're light with a 6-2, I think, you know, the way it's been selected. And I think you're obviously using Blair Kinghorn as your full back option. We're obviously missing a position, like, in terms of an out and out winger. And I also wonder, as Johnny was kind of alluding to there with the left footed option, surely Joe Schmidt, like, if you turn Blair Kinghorn on his wing, it's going to be very hard to swing a left footed option away, you know, so a left footed kick option away. So that's where it's going to get you. So most of the time you can get away with it, but, like, you know, Kinghorn got away with it last week. I think the Lions had possession at that stage of the game. They had most of the kind of dominance, so he wasn't really caught on the back foot. But if Joe Schmidt can come up with plays that can allow Lionel to bounce back and get the ball over Kinghorn's head in between Kinghorn and Keenan, then there's not going to be a very easy exit. They're going to have to play out. They're going to have to set up a ruck and exit, or they're going to have to try and run away. And that's where teams might get under a bit of pressure and make poor decisions, you know. So if they can get on the front foot and get some balls onto the grass in between Kinghorn and Keenan, there could be a bit of problem there.
And I do think on that, they'll be praying that it's not a left winger that goes down first. So if Kinghorn goes off, that's where the trouble, where you can, you know, right wing is a bit easier to cover because they're all right footed and you can, you know, as Johnny's already said, but historically left winger is probably a bit more difficult backfield cover. In your 3-2 split, you can have two full backs. On the right wing, you can defend as kind of a third centre when they're 13-2. So you just stay up in the line. Where, you know, in your defensive system there, what are they going to do? They're just going to put, you know, Alex Mitchell or whoever comes on. Are they going to defend with, you know, in multi-phase with 9 in the backfield just to kind of control that a bit more? Look, they're going to have run through all of these options. Like, it's going to be interesting to see if it does happen with a left winger, who's going to be that second guy in the backfield when it comes to multi-phase, or how are they going to set up? Will they set up whoever comes on the wing, set him up in the 9 position in the line out at the front of the line out and have Jameson Gibson-Park in the backfield? Or do you play 2 9s and just have, you know, Jameson Gibson-Park in the backfield and have Mitchell there covering the back? So it is that second spot in the backfield that's going to be the problem, because I think you want Keenan and probably one of your 9s. You don't want, where if you're Keenan and Kinghorn, you're rock solid. But if you go the other way, I just think it'll be a better dynamic with one of the 9s in the backfield, given how, you know, football orientated both 9s are.
Then if you go to the contestable game, like, you have to fight, you have to cut your claw some way. But
yeah, exactly.
And next thing, like, he's beating everyone in the air as it is. And if you've got a 9 like Gibson Park in the backfield, So I think it'll have to be Jones, but Farrell has done this before. Van der Fleer trying to line out all sorts of stuff. It's probably something we have.
Yeah. I do think that if they move Hugh Jones won't be in the backfield. It'll be, you know, in terms of that, it'll be, you know, Freeman and Keenan in the backfield, or Kinghorn and Freeman in the backfield. I don't think you'll just let Hugh Jones defend as that third centre in the, you know, on the open wing.
Yeah, so you'll line up differently on attack compared to defence if that happens.
Yeah. You'll figure out your set phase. You'll probably see that Hugh Jones will probably always defend on the open wing or blind, you know, like, and you'll get your backfield sorted with your 9 retreating back to the backfield and having Freeman and your nine retreating back to blindside, so he's last man on the blindside with your two back three players in the backfield.
I think the beauty of this is that like they're the best players around the place. So if you give them, you know, some details of their positioning 2 days out, they'll just pick it up. You know, like you saw Arlen Aki swapped, I think from line out was it? And they swapped from scrum in terms of their defensive positions. Farrell's defending at 13, you know, so they're good enough players that you can give them a role and say, if this happens, you're going there, and they just flick into gear. That's probably the part of being a better player. You know, they digest that information, just execute it, you know.
Yeah.
Tell me if this is a stupid question, but considering we've spent the last few minutes debating all the, if this happens, this player goes here, and we talk through all the contingencies of what needs to happen and the holes that they could have if players get injured, why do you think he's gone with a 6-2 split? Because obviously he's gone 5-3 the last two games in a row, and it's worked out all right. Is there any particular reason you think he feels he needs another forward out there?
Personally, I think it's because of how Australia got on top in terms of the power game early doors, that it gives you some fresh legs in the last kind of 20 minutes in the front five, and you look at the bench and the back row that could be finishing with Morgan, Earl, Chesham in the second row. You know, you have a lot of kind of groundhogs there in the last kind of 15, 20 minutes if Australia are going to throw caution to the wind, where you can really get after them at the breakdown. That's for me, and I just think it gives you that luxury that you can just say, right, here we go, we're gonna really attack the breakdown the last kind of 10-15 minutes and take that away from them, take their power game away, or if they want to throw caution to the wind.
I also
and
think,
Johnny Hollett.
Yeah, there's an element of not wanting to make your changes, you know, so if he's not going to make his backs, maybe he just felt like it was a bit of a luxury item and he, as John could have done with it in the backs or something. Like, he didn't even swap Jameson Gibbs Park last week, did he?
No.
You know, and I know that's not like there's still a nine on the bench. That's not even the one you're talking about. But maybe he's just willing to, and it'll be typical. This is the time when he's going to have to make a change, and all of a sudden you're scrambling. But that's the risk you take. I think if all things were equal, he wouldn't be changing three backs at the weekend. You know, so it'll have to be a forced change, I would say. And maybe he just felt it was a bit too much of a luxury item, and he could do with the forward after, you know. And maybe it's showing us what they're going to do as well. Maybe they're just going to look to beat them up and have a reaction on what happened in the first half of last week.
In a worst case scenario, they've heard you've heard that, you know, Ben Earl has been able to play at 12, so like he has the athleticism that he's able to do that. In a worst case scenario, if you lose three backs, you know, it's first phase where you can get done, but you can figure that out with the players that you have. Now if you lose two of 10, 12 or 13, that's where you're under pressure, because someone is gonna have to defend a 13 that's probably not used to it.
There is a small part of me wondering, was he anticipating Australia going 6-2 on the bench again? And if he had his time back now that he's seen they've gone 5-3, would he do the same? But anyway, we'll see how it develops on Saturday. One last bit on the team news I want to talk about as well, because and we have spoken about him a few times now this summer on the podcast, but Tadhg Furlong, this is his third Lions tour, so out of a possible nine tests, he will have started all nine. I listed it off there beforehand. Only four players have started more consecutive tests for the Lions: Willie John McBride, Graham Price, Reece Williams and Tony O'Reilly. Alan Wynne-Jones is the only player in the professional era to have played or started nine tests Makavunipola also played nine tests, but Alan Wynne-Jones started nine tests. And it moves him inside the top 10 all-time Lions appearance holders. And to go back on as well, I think only three or four Irish players have more Lions appearances than him. Willie John McBride, Tony O'Reilly there as well. And Mike Gibson is the other as well. It's an absolutely astonishing record when you look back at it.
I think, like, you know, Furlong's been injured in and out, and he's a tight-head prop that we say is so important. But, like, you get the Paul O'Connell, Alan Wynne-Jones stature in the middle of the pack, and people talk about them forever. But, like, when you say that, I read it this morning about Alan Wynne-Jones having nine test starts, not consecutive, is it? But when you put him into the same category, like Alanwyn Jones is a Lions legend. He's a Welsh hero. Like he's.
I'll just clear. Alanwyn Jones did have 9 consecutive. So Furlong's matched him. Makovunipola has played 9, but they weren't all starts.
Well, I wasn't sure how it was when I read it, but regardless, it doesn't really matter. He's on the same record as Alanwyn Jones, which I think when you digest that, it shows you. Even as much as we recognise how good he is, maybe we underappreciate, you know, the level that he's been at. We said it on the podcast a few times that, like, when he's mostly fit, it's a non-conversation run whether he starts or not. Never mind when he's fit, you know. So I think, you know, there should be some respect put on. I think there's some respect on him. Don't get me wrong, but I think we should really get the magnitude of what Ty Furlong has done for Irish rugby as well.
Yeah, and I think in terms of where he's come from this season, in terms of in-out injury and then to have the longevity to get through the full, you know, which is a really grueling tour to get out and then put put all that on the park it's fair going with, you know, his fitness coming in, because he would have to have been short of, you know, he was always fit, but, you know, like short of match fitness, and to pick it up that quickly in that period for a prop is exceptional. So it's and you hear him talking last week about how the Lions has molded him as a rugby player and what he's got out of it, and it's great. But like, to be in the same conversation as you say, as from an Irish perspective, really, John McBride, Tony O'Reilly, and Gibson, it's mad. It's incredible, and he certainly is a generational player for Ireland in terms of what he's given to the thing, and that's not said lightly, because you look back at his record, it's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the all-time list here. I don't think anyone is going to catch Willie John out on 17, just because they're not going to be playing the 4 and 5 test series like they were back in the day. Dickie Jeeps, 13, Mike Gibson, Graham Price and Alanwyn Jones, all test or 12 Lions test caps, Rhys Williams, Tony O'Reilly and Gareth Edwards on 10. And then you have Tadhg Furlong alongside Sid Miller, Andy Irvine and Makovunipola, who'll be on 9. Okay, that's the team news for this weekend sorted. I wanted to talk about that first, because I did not want to get us getting lost and wasting 90% of this podcast talking about...
Oh, look at Johnny. He's taking a deep breath. He's ready to rock here. He's ready to go.
I found it hilarious. On Monday, I went out doing the Wallabies press conference. It was Nick Frost and Max Jorgensen chatting to the media, and the Australian media were just referring to, they never specifically talked about, you know, Jack Morgan's clear out on Carlo Tizzano. They just started talking to the players about the incident, and they just kept calling it the incident. And we know what the incident is. It is Jack Morgan's late clear out on Carlo Tizzano leading up to Hugo Keenan's try. We've all seen the replays. We've had 4 or 5 days of conversation about it, but we haven't had our turn yet. You've had your turn, Johnny Holland. You covered it extensively, and Dan Sheehan's try as well. And just, I suppose, the vagueness around laws and how Andrea Piardi probably was in a no-win situation there. There was no actual... But like, whichever way he decided was the correct way and the incorrect way as well. I just want to bring up some of the quotes Joe Schmidt had today, because he was asked about Carlo Tizzano and the criticism he would have got in the last few days for his overreaction and going down holding his head when they were saying the whatever happened might have hit him on the neck. But this is how prepared Joe Schmidt was coming to this press conference. He's had a really tough week, Carlo. He's copped a lot of online abuse. And the only thing I'd say in defense of Carlo is that just over 54 Gs of direct force went through his neck, along with almost 2,200 revs of rotational force, which is enough to cause serious injury. Not to a rugby player who's as well conditioned as Carlo, but he's probably best just to take a deep breath. I think we're all aware of Newton's third law, that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. When the force hits him and the speed of his head collapsing down, he recoiled out the back of the ruck. I don't think he wanted a recoil like that, but that's the nature of the force. There's an equal and opposite reaction. I didn't know what was going on in there for a second. I was Googling G-force and what triggers gum shields and, you know, is 54 G's a lot? I don't know. You hear it a lot talking about Formula One drivers and stuff. There's a lot in this, isn't there?
There's a lot in it. I think that's a complete and utter rabbit hole. And I think interestingly when he says that he's got 54 G's hit on his neck, you know, I don't like people being hit on the neck, but like the laws are, well, I suppose it is the shoulder line, but like they're talking about him being hit in the head and all of a sudden he's talking about it being hit in the neck. So like, look, going back to it, I think your point on Piardi is right. Like he was in a no-win situation because, and this is what I was talking about in my column, I suppose, is that like the laws are so poorly written now, or not that they're poorly written, they're written fine if we abide by them, but we don't. So they're not refereed like that. They're not expected to be refereed like that. And if they were, we'd be up in arms, like, you know. And I remember writing an article about the Jackal. It was actually probably more than weeks ago.
I remember that one, yeah.
And I can't remember what the incident was, but, you know, we're talking about how do we make it safer to clear them out. And at the end of it, I was like, do you know what? Can we not just get rid of the Jackal? And I actually don't even like huge change in the game. Change annoys me, like, you know. So when I'm saying that, I just kind of stopped for a second, was thinking, it's illegal anyway. But the laws, it's actually illegal. You're not allowed to put your head below your hips. So why are we still allowing it? It's actually a position that we're encouraging people to get into. And as a coach, you do, you know, like, you're allowing it to happen. You send people in there. And yet in the laws, it's not allowed, and referees are allowing it every week. So like, when did the Jackal actually become allowed? That's my biggest thing. And then when you go back into other aspects of the law and how we referee it, he was absolutely never going to get the call right. And funnily enough, I think what I said in my summary was, I think he was right in how he called it, because the laws are now gone to, like, they're not black and white. It's like common law and judgment. And I think if you go on the last 5 years of rugby, I think he got the call just about right. But it's so wrong that it's right, if you know what I mean. Like, the laws are written absolutely against what he called and judged.
Just in terms of getting rid of the Jackal, can't get rid of the Jackal. People like me made a career out of dominating a wide breakdown. So like, you can't get rid of the, I know they've changed the rules. In my time, you could actually hold on to someone as they were tackled. It was deadly, but you didn't have to release. I think on the first thing on the Joe Smith comments around the G-force and stuff, you can't take that as an isolated incident, because if he's going to go down that, okay, we'll then analyze every single contact throughout the whole game and then have a baseline and see where they're at. I would say there's probably there, and I don't know the stats, he probably has them in front of him, but there are probably contacts throughout the game that have more. And, you know, so you can't, that are perfectly legal or illegal or whatever way you want to think. Everything is down to interpretation. Like, even you know, Nigel Owens has been this week, if you follow him on social media, he spoke about Dan Sheehan's try, and he said letter of the law is for interpretation. He ends with, you know, you're not like, you're, it's different between a normal tackle situation, but he's clearly diving, and he said, like, you can dive in the act of scoring, but you can also tackle someone in the air while they are in the act of scoring. So where is that? I think that's a piece of whoever came up with it. I think it's a good piece of coaching, because in that area, usually you have one tackle, you know, you have a chop on top or whatever people call it, one low, one high. But in that area, everyone goes low to stop them. So I think it's a good piece of tactical nous, and, you know, the two guys who come to tackle him both go low and he just goes over them. And, you know, so again, it's down to interpretation. So yeah, I my first view watching it live in the moment, not slow-mo, was that's a great clear out. They both chase the ball. They're both concentrating on the ball. Both sets of hips, both sets of shoulders are below each other's hips, and the collision is won, and we're a collision sport by the cleaner. When you slow it down and they were starting to look at it, I was like, oh, this is interesting. But
there's the natural assumption that as soon as he went to look at it, oh god, yeah, you know, I think we've just kind of been conditioned into that. And I think it's one of those. For me personally, this might sound like a cop-out, but I do just think the right decision in that case, because there's so many ways you can look at it, is whichever way Andrea Piardi called it in the moment is probably the right way to call it. And if he had any bit of bit of marketing nous about him. He might have turned it over and given it to the Wallabies, and I'm sure there would have been plenty of Lions organisers delighted to have a series decider in Sydney this week. But he obviously stuck with his decision, and it's obviously going to split a room. I did found it interesting today, Joe Schmidt. He was asked about Tadhg Furlong and his experiences of coaching him. Obviously, we mentioned the milestone Furlong is going to hit this weekend, and he was just generally asked about, you know, you coached Joe way back when, and you gave him his debut, et cetera, et cetera. And he actually spoke about the last time Ireland toured Australia back in 2018. And in one of the tests, all week they'd been talking about David Pocock. David Pocock is just lethal over the ball. If you see him go in for it, you've got to get him out of there. You've got to do whatever you can to stop him getting a hold of that ball. And he referenced at one point in, I can't remember which test it was now, but Pocock goes in over the ball and it looks like he's about to rip a brilliant jackal. And Joe Schmidt talked about how Tadhg Furlong came out of nowhere and absolutely blew him out of it with one of the greatest clear outs he's ever seen in his life. And as we were getting a taxi across town from Joe Schmidt's press conference to Andy Farrell's press conference this afternoon, one of my journalistic colleagues managed to dig out the clip of that clear out on his phone. And it is almost frame by frame a copy of Jack Morgan on Carlo Tizzano at the weekend. And Joe Schmidt was talking about how this was one of the great clear outs he's ever seen. So I think that's a great way to sum it up, because it kind of depends what side of the fence you're on. Quickly on Dan Sheehan's try. Not really too concerned with whether or not you think it should have been allowed, but there's two questions I want to ask you. First of all, do you think that was something they had come up with in advance, or did Dan Sheehan just kind of react to his quotes? He says they hadn't planned anything beforehand. It was just a reaction to getting what he said absolutely melted by a couple of tackles off the previous penalty. But given how Andrea Piardi awarded the try straight away, and there was no debate around it, do you think it's possible that was something they'd come up with in the week? They meet with referees, they discuss potential things, and they said, look, if we have a 5 meter try, are we allowed dive for the line or dive over tacklers? Do you think there was a little bit of consultation done earlier on in the week?
I actually don't know which one it was. Like, it's very hard to tell unless they tell you about the referee and the conversations. But I do think, from my perspective, Dan Sheehan's contact skills are so good, you know, and I can't imagine. I've never carried as a hooker into these tap penalties. So like, I'm quite sure you'd have to do 100 of them before you feel like you're competent enough to slip the tackle as going over it. Because otherwise, like, if you go in high and you get melted, like, you're going to be sore anyway for a start. And you're going to be away from the try line. So it just strikes me that a guy like that has been in that situation so many times with Leinster and Ireland that he just got a notion to slip that tackle in whatever way he can. Because, you know, picture yourself even standing in front of it. There's guys lining you up. Some hookers don't even like carrying that ball. You know, they just collapse onto the floor and get the ball away. You know, so
he said the same thing.
Yeah, it's a rotten place to be. When you think about it, there's heads and all different, like the same height. We're asking for trouble, you know. So, you know, maybe it's the lesser of two evils actually slipping it over over the tackle. But I didn't like the action of it. I don't like jumping into, you can say he was scoring a try. If that's a guy racing for a corner and jumping to get there and there's a tackle in the air and there's, you know, a bit of chat about that, fair enough. But like running directly at the try line and jumping over it, I'm not so sure that law is going to stay for too long. Like, but I think Dan Sheehan, you know, we talk about him maybe, but it's not highlighted how world-class he is. That's a world-class moment for him and his contact skills.
Yeah, I would agree. You don't know until they're completely honest with you whether it has happened, but it's a moment of magic from him. And it's not bending the rules, it's applying the laws to suit you in a moment. And, you know, we've seen moments like that throughout the, you know, like Conor Murray in terms of putting a ball down, coming through a ruck because the ball's over the line, and just finding a tiny, tiny little window that gives you an edge on your opposition. And that was one of those moments. So I'd be a bit like Johnny. I'm not mad on the jump and the tackle stuff, but when you look at it for what it is, from tactical nous, game understanding, manipulating a situation to suit you, it's exactly what we want to see in terms of stuff like that in terms of innovation, and when they change it, they change it. But you know, if it happens this week, you'll be sure there'll be one guy going low and one guy trying to catch him and holding him up over the line if he does do it again.
Yeah, and like it's similar to a couple of weeks ago with South Africa against Italy, where you had that situation where they were lifting players up in, yeah, in open space, and look, World Rugby might come clamping down on it. I know the first one, the kickoff one that they tried, where they deliberately kicked the ball short. That obviously, yeah, should have been a penalty. That was just an incorrect application of the of the law. But it will be interesting, mm-hmm, to see if something, yeah, is changed on that, or at the very least, how teams react if it happens again. Yeah.
There is a couple of things on the rules and the laws. Like Raj in commentary, when Stewart, you know, there's about 6 or 7 minutes ago, he's a really good carry, gets free, then kind of his momentum, he doesn't necessarily go to roll on purpose, but his momentum carries him forward and it's a penalty against him. The Lions are very much on top there. Australia are going back. There was no one held them. There's no one near him in terms of getting on the ball. It's clear a momentum. Yes, the tackle was in and around. But there's stuff like that that does happen. I find when the game is quick and there's an extra roll, it's out of momentum and someone not being able to control their body weight because they've got so much forward momentum. And particularly when it's not like they forward momentum and they're running into a structured defensive line. They were a bit staggered. He gets good go forward, good footwork, and then it's an extra roll just because of the momentum. He's penalized for that. There's stuff like that that I think happens organically that's being penalized. I think it can be very hard. Now, there are guys 100% that do roll and extra, and we've stopped that. But in certain incidences like that, I think there can be a bit more, as Johnny said, common sense or opinion applied to that was tackled, but his momentum has given him, there's no chance of a jackal for anyone. There's not really anything in it play, you know. And then also the hit out on the back to the very start of the conversation, Duncan Casey, you know, teammate of ours, he did a thing this week where actually the Australian defender doesn't come in through the gate and is actually side entry, and he quoted the law. So if you really want to get to the nitty gritty, then
I actually interpreted the role a little bit differently, but I won't argue with you. The other part of it is, when I was reading it, going, yeah, the first infringement is in the side, and you could argue who's about to go off his feet anyway, but foul play kind of precedes any of those.
Takes advantage, yeah.
Whack him in the head, and it's going to be a penalty the other way anyway, and possibly a card. But I think the reason I have two things on the referees here. The reason I said that it's a lose-lose for them, like there is the research in after the 2019 World Cup showed that like 37% of infringements aren't called in the breakdown. I think that reduced to 35% when they did a follow-up study. I can't remember, was it the Autumn Nations League or whatever it was? It was another competition anyway, 2020, and it was 35% infringements not called. But like 79% of the ones not called, or there was a stat around, you know, the attacking team are the ones infringing 70% of the time, and they're penalised less than the defensive side. But obviously, we're trying to enforce an attacking game, but you can't just pick and choose. Yeah. Like that's where the kind of judging call annoys me a small bit. And of the ones that were, I think the highest one that wasn't called was head below hips, which is the jackal position, and the next one is off feet. So like we're just getting them into a whole load of bother. Like the rucks are so quick, there's guys flying into it. They're not going to see everything. I understand that, and you want to have a bit of momentum around the game and a bit of fluidity. But if you just like my thing is always like referees will say we need to manage the game and we let this go because this happened or this person's doing something. There's two infringements, let it go. But for me, if you just actually apply the laws, you get your game management. This is always my argument. I speak personally with the referees whenever I get a chance, and like I always say, just penalize us. Like if you're going to have to do it both sides, but penalize us and we'll all change our behaviors. You know? But the last thing I would say on it is, I know there's a directive with the referees to not call a game. So don't be the one to decide the game. So in this instance, it's a 50-50 call. And by going back, he's calling the game. By leaving it play, the Lions have called the game, if you know what I mean. And I'm not sure I really like that either in terms of don't be the one to call it. There was a penalty, I think, in the La Rochelle Leinster game. Around a drop goal, like I can't really remember the situation, but I know a referee said, our referee coach was like, "Ah, oh, don't be the one to call that. You know, let them play it out and let's see who wins." I guess the I get what they're trying to do. Don't be the talking point, but in the end, we're the talking point as a result. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And I completely agree with you on that in terms of penalize them. Like, I'm big on, I genuinely believe that poor technique should be penalized instantly in the sense of a tackle. So if your foot is wrong, if you're high, mm-hmm. and you know the way they talk and they have a conversation, and okay, there was head contact, but it was minimal and it's penalty only. But someone is really upright in the tackle, they're on their heels, there's no force. But my point to that is, it's poor technique. So penalize them, give them a yellow card. Don't just penalize them, yellow card, because whether it's the force for me is not that important in trying to change behavior. If you have a guy who has poor technique and he's upright in the tackle all the time and he gets yellow card twice in four games, he won't be long about changing their tackle technique. And that's the thing. I do think that they need to be stronger on an incident where the defender has poor technique. It's high contact, it's head contact, but, oh, well, there was no force, so it's just a penalty. No, give him a yellow card. Because and then it negates the, there are incidents like Furlong's one, say, you know, where he goes to clean and your man is up. That's a penalty because there's contact, not a lot of force. He actually catches him, but there's nothing Furlong can do there in that clean out because your man is literally bouncing on the way back up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a millimeter either way, he doesn't catch him on the head. But I do think, particularly in a tackle situation, poor technique, if it leads to head contact, should be a yellow card minimum, not just a penalty.
Can I just say, just before it gets interpreted the wrong way, like I'm on the referee's side here. Like if they feel there's something to penalise, if they award a penalty, there's coaches and supporters everywhere going, "Ah, oh, it wasn't that bad."
Well,
it wasn't, like, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
the reaction to ruining the game, blah blah blah. I think that's what's stopping refs from just penalising everything they see. You know, so if we can accept some of the things that are actually wrong, I think they'll have more confidence or more direction from their coaches and the uppers to actually just keep penalising until it changes. Like you see when a directive comes in, the Sternham tackle in the AIL, for example, and people tackling, like, penalty, penalty, penalty until you change your behaviours. And then it slips for a while, naturally. But at the start, I honestly think most coaches say, all right, fair enough. And then you'll argue some and it gets frustrating, but you're a bit more frustrated at yourself or your players, you know, and it comes out poorly sometimes. But, like, I do think if we can just accept them a small bit more, it's the referee that's finding this one tough. And I think it's too hard for them when there's that many infringements and breakdowns because the whole thing has gone fairly messy, you know?
Yeah.
If I'm Andrea Piardi in that moment, I'm just pretending my earpiece doesn't work. And I've dropped it about 10 yards back. I'll just carry on. Before we finish up, I just want to wrap up on a couple of general thoughts around this weekend. And Johnny Holland, it was something you mentioned earlier on when we were touching on the team news, is that there's part of you, obviously, that would love to have seen Farrell make a few more changes. Give someone like Josh van der Vlier a go. Throw Henry Pollock in there. See how he goes in a test. And a few others as well as that. Because I think there's quite a few who haven't actually... I think he's only used 27 players across these three test matches. But is the fact that he has used so few players and has been so careful and not really throwing out caps, particularly now that the series is won, do you think that is a huge, huge sign of respect for both wanting to go and secure a whitewash, which is something the Lions haven't done against the Wallabies in a three-test series in 121 years, I believe, 1904, and also just a sign of respect for the concept of the Lions and the test series and for their opposition as well?
I think from listening to some of the videos and Andy Farrer for a long time now, I think the first part is respecting the Lions jersey and respecting, like, you know, earning it and everything else. So I completely get that. And as I said earlier, it's easy for us to say, oh, I just want to see Henry Pollock play and have a crack off the Wallabies. Like, you know, that's kind of fan talk anyway. You know, I understand that. Mm. But I think with respect to the Lions jersey, there's respect to Australia as well. Because I honestly think Australia will win this one. It'll be 2-1. And I think if he had made changes, I'll get back to that in a second. I'm not sure if I fully agree with it yet, but I think, you know, if he made too many changes and they've won, people go, it might as well have been 3-0. But if they don't make the changes and Australia win, it'll be a good 2-1. And I think Australia will get good momentum going into the Rugby Championship. And and their trajectory is on the right path. But yeah, there is, and I'd love to, I don't mean like wholesale changes. I just love to have seen Josh Van der Fleer on a bench. Maybe Ben White, but then that's harsh and Alex Mitchell not coming on last week, but then White being not coming on last week. So one or two that are very, very close. I'd like to have seen some of those changes, but not wholesale changes. And maybe I'll go back to the predictions in a while, but I just think the Katie Taylor video was class, and she was talking about your will. And I think the will is going to be very, very strong for Australia this week. And professional at the highest end of the game or not, I think there's a small bit of comfort going to... Well, the challenge for the coaches this week is not to allow comfort get into the Lions camp, but human nature. And that's probably the reason why I'm thinking it could swing. But they don't have Valentini, who was a huge, huge player for them in 40 minutes, you know.
Just on the Katie Taylor thing, I was going to bring it up. I think that's amazing, and on so many levels. Like, you know, people speak about legacy in sport, and if you look at it from her side, what she's done for female boxing in general, for female sport, and for her to be asked, because of what she's done and how she carries herself and what she does day in, day out. And like, boxers are, like, in my opinion, they're the best form of athlete. They have to be quick, they have to be powerful, they have to have mental toughness, and they have to have control. When someone's trying to beat the head off you, not if you lose control, you'll get knocked out. And I just think they have to have everything to reach the highest level, and she has that. And for her to be asked to speak to, like, without getting too involved in, but a group of male professional sports people in a trilogy, and the connection across that, like, it's just incredible. And I posted on LinkedIn about it yesterday. Like, it's incredible on a number of things, just sport in general, the cross-pollination between male and female sports. You've seen what the kind of Lionesses have done for the English kind of soccer fans. But as a father of a daughter, it's just so cool to be able to sit down and show that to your daughter, who sometimes they can kind of, you know, dip in and out of sport, but to have this legacy for her. And then you look at the faces in the video and how engaged each and every one of them were. It's just, I think it's a masterful piece of connection, storytelling from Andy Farrell and his backroom staff. And I just thought it was absolutely amazing. Thought it was brilliant.
It's probably a meaty subject for me to bring up right towards the end of a podcast. But speaking to like two coaches here, it's something that's spoken about so much about Andy Farrell, just his man management and understanding about being able to hit the right emotional pitch in terms of preparing teams for games. And he was even asked today, for example, about what he has planned for like a jersey presentation this week, and he wouldn't give any details, but he said they have something lined up for this week in particular. Not only Katie last week, but you know, they brought in Martin Johnson, for example, to present the jerseys before the game last Thursday, and he was brought in specifically because he's been there and done it across two Lions tours on opposite sides of the win and loss column. In 1997, he was part of a Lions team that went out and won the second test and brought a series home. 4 years later, he was in Australia and they didn't get it done and they lost it. A week before that, he had the players' families to come in and hand out the jerseys in this incredible ceremony down in the Botanical Garden in Brisbane. So I suppose in a long-winded way, how difficult is it to hit that emotional tone right ahead of a big game?
Yeah, I think it's something you learn as you're coaching. Like when I first retired, I thought it was give them as much technical and tactical advice and strategy as you can. And you build on that as you go. And then I was taught a bit of a lesson in Cork, kind of like a fella telling me, one of our stalwarts, in fairness to him, taught me a lesson. I wouldn't like to say it to him, but he was like, you didn't capture us. Like, you didn't really give us the real why. And I kind of went, fuck that. Like, and then I gave him everything. And then as I reflected on it, I went, so I saw right. And listening to Andy Farrell, he actually did. He went to a Carcan business sport lunch a couple of seasons ago, two, three years ago, the World Cup year. And some of the stuff he had said, you know, why they were going on their pre-season tour, why they were playing certain matches, you know that the narrative with him is so strong, you know. And again, I think he hit the right note. Like Johnny's talking about all the different layers of connection that he has with that Katie Taylor video. There's so much to it. He didn't just land on, oh, Katie Taylor was fighting recently, you know. There's way, way more to that. So I think, you know, man management, yes. I think the man management is one thing. Yeah, he does get on with the players and he has a way, and he has a way of cutting through it as well. You know, that's what we've obviously gotten from him. But I think his man management is a result of how he sets himself up. You know, he fully believes in what they're doing. He sets them up really well. He gives them a story. He gets serious buy-in from them. So when they have buy-in and he tells them they're out, they're either trying to prove themselves to him, or actually, as I spoke to another player, even when you're selected, you're trying to prove yourself to him. So, like, I think the man management has become easier because of what he gives them in terms of narrative and buy-in and everything else. But it clearly is just a quality that he has. He's been involved in sports at a high level for a long, long time. That video of him as a fitter, isn't it? Going up to 17 years of age.
That was amazing.
He looks like a 25-year-old. So he probably has a couple of kids on the way at that stage. Andy Farrell starting young, but like he's in this thing a long time. He's learned a lot and a very inspiring character.
Yeah, incredible. I think his emotional connection to people is, you know, and as Johnny says, you learn from experience in terms of, you know, your mistakes and what worked and what didn't work and how you want to do that. And then each group was different, but his experience lends himself to be able to have that. And, you know, I think it also helps that, you know, he's from the north of England and the background that he has, you know, people automatically just engage with him. And what he did in his own career is madness too. So, you know, he commands that ultimate respect, but he doesn't play on that. He brings you in with you know, personal connection, and you know, everyone just he's just you can't speak highly enough of him from what you hear from the people, and even the short snippets of playing against them and meeting him every now and again, and he's an incredible leader.
Final thoughts. Johnny Holland has hinted he thinks the Wallabies are going to make a 2-1 at the weekend. Johnny Murphy, what way are you leaning?
I'm going to go 3-0, and I'm going to a 4-point win for the Lions, and it'll be the opposite way around, that the Lions, I think the Lions will be holding on to that in the last 5 minutes, and Australia will be going for the win. That's me.
Quick little summary, Johnny Holland, of why you think the Wallabies are gonna do it, because you only hinted at it. You gave it a soft launch.
Yeah, I think it's less tactical and more mindset. But I suppose I'm throwing it out there, because if Australia win, I'll say I told you so. But if the Lions win, I never really said it, did I? No, I just think, like, when that Katie Taylor thing, the will to win, no right to win, all that kind of stuff, and then when you flip it around, how annoyed are Australia? How annoyed is Joe Schmidt? He'll work to the bone this week to come up with something that will catch the Lions off guard. That's kind of where I'm going with it. I'm not sure if there's a tactical way. You know, on paper they're not the team that's going to win it. But again, go to All-Ireland finals and my own Rebel County, I don't think you've the right to win anything, you know, unfortunately. So, and we're hurting, you know, but I think there's an element to that about it. And I think they can harness something to get the win.
For myself, I do have a sneaky feeling that the Lions are going to win and win comfortably. There's been a sense around Australia, just I'm kind of purely going off the dejection of what I've seen from Wallabies players and from Joe Schmidt. And I think just so much emotional energy and physical energy obviously was put into last week. I could see them really struggling to repeat that again. I do hope I'm wrong, because I'd absolutely love to see another brilliant game. And I'm just delighted last Saturday in the MCG that the game itself matched the setting and the surroundings and the atmosphere, because that was an incredible stadium to be in on Saturday night. And it's absolutely brilliant that the second test turned out to be such a thriller, because there's been talk, obviously, people suggesting that the Wallabies should be off the Lions schedule. I think a lot of those questions were answered last weekend. Fellas, I've taken up enough of your time. It's been a pleasure having you both, as always, Johnny Murphy and Johnny Holland. RT Rugby Podcast will be back next week, looking back on the Lions tour as a whole. And we'll also start looking at the Women's Rugby World Cup, Ireland taking on Scotland this weekend in their first warm-up game. We'll have a bit of reaction to that as well. A reminder, live blog for the Lions this Saturday on rte.ie/sport. And you can get all your reaction later on during the day on Saturday Sport on RT Radio 1. Cheers, fellas.